more up-to-date ways. That said, some of the stuff last time, using pound, you remember, to continue on from Fuller, was a way of getting into, I hoped, into the central things of the cantos, and also into a great deal more in our course, because that finally the synthesis is this idea of the possibility of making a place on the earth, not just living on it as it is, but making a place. That's what we're concerned with. And it is a profoundly unbiblical, unchristian, unromantic idea that the city is a viable place. That you make something on the earth. You don't live in a hole or scrabble around on the earth. You know, use minimal tools because they're wicked, like Jacques Ellul and his theory of technology would suggest. The idea of maximum technology to build the city. And as we ended with some of that stuff in Norman O. Brown's essay on politics and metapolitics, which I here worked out for you. Well, and again, I don't know how far I mentioned this, but the whole of Patterson, even including Book 5, I think, although it's not quite so obvious, is dedicated to the possibility of the renewal of the city. And a lot of the stresses and strains inside William Carlos Williams's marvelous poem are to do with the great backlog of agrarian emphasis inside Williams's sensibility. I mean, we're putting it in itself very, very briefly. I mean, the tensions in there are his knowledge of the agrarian roots of America, and which go into the Constitution through Locke, Jefferson, 18th century Enlightenment people, who are strictly non-technological. There's not the slightest suggestion anywhere in 18th century Enlightenment thinking that machinery and high technology will be a basis for society at all. And that is what really is basically wrong with the American Constitution, if I may be so pompous and awful, but it really is the best case now right now. Never through rural city antagonism. And I'm upset I brought up Jefferson this morning and what happens after that, his ideas extending into America now. William Carlos Williams' knowledge is that when he was training in New York, and when he was a young doctor in New York, in the worst parts of the city, in like city hospitals of the poorest kind, his knowledge of exactly what the city could be like. And yet continually his knowledge that, one of the big examples is atomic fusion, that it isn't necessarily high technology, disastrous, that it is that out of the division and fusion image inside the making of radium by the Curies, which he transposes into the idea of divorce and then creativity, inside that idea of necessary break in order to create, breaking the paradigms in order to make the fission and then the fusion, it becomes a major idea. The moving on. So it isn't anything like a static work at all. As you know, it was an open-ended work. Book 6 was there. Notes for Book 6 were there when he died. I guess I wanted open-ended exploratory work. There's no question, you see, of these poems, the big epic poems like Maximus, Patterson, A, and the Cantos, all finally devoted to this big articulative synthesis of the polis. There's no question of them filling an existing mold, which is exactly like the structure of town planning. The difference between Haussmann's boulevard structure for Paris and, what's the guy's name? Oh, my head completely, the guy that laid down the grid for Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, Haussmann. There's nothing like that, you know, of a grid. Although it was modified in Washington, I better add quickly. The canal was built where he didn't want it. There's nothing about like imposing on the earth a grid and saying, okay, city. And then you live in it, you know. You live in those right angles called the intersections between Second Avenue and 16th Street. Do you see what I mean? There's nothing like that imposed grid on the face of the earth. It's a question of building it and making quite certain that, in fact, is this what Lawrence Halperin would call an open-ended program, that the city is modified according to the needs and requirements of people in it. There isn't a fourth thing, and as I said to you last time, it's very much to do with the whole structure of making forms now, in dance, in film, in city planning, and in politics. This is the 20th century, this is the best side of the 20th century, these fantastic opportunities now, understanding. Well, the next stage in my notes here, we've already done it a bit of, but I've changed the structure, and that was Paul Goodman's criticism of Buckminster Fulham in Community Ash. So, and the guaranteed income idea there. So I don't want to particularly do that, again, with this kind of waste of time. What I want to do is to move on toward other problems to do with the criticism of comprehensive design and the city, and use Goodman. Now, let me start here. Remember that in chapter 6 of Communitas, where we saw the Goodmans tackling Fuller's idea of a society of architects, common laborers, and consumers. I quote page 82, a wishful control of everybody else by the self-effacing universal architects or comprehensive designers. Idea. He goes from that to have a look at Frank Lloyd Wright's solution to the city problem, which is basically Jeffersonian regional planning, to say it historically straight off. This is page 88 to 89. That is, if you're interested in this, have a look at Frank Lloyd Wright's conception of what he called Broadacre City, which is based on a mixture of corporate capitalism and limited private ownership. That is exactly the Jeffersonian position. A confused political integration then of urban and rural, without, as the Goodman say, making industrial life human and worthwhile. The next stage in the book, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, is taken as an example of, I quote, an possible alternative, which they call multiple-use enterprise, with benefits spread down the whole river area. The implication being that I take it you know about the Tennessee Valley Authority, that although it is in fact modeled very much on a hierarchical structure inside itself, at least the benefits are spread, and at least it was in its first conditions an open-ended structure. There was the idea, okay, we'll do that to control the basic geographical and geological problems. Then we'll see what in fact benefits accrue, and there was an open-ended thing to it until it was stamped on by the government and tightened up and made into a corporate thing based on capitalist principles. In fact, it was, as the Goodman pointed out, I made a note here now, that it was wrecked by the Tennessee Valley Authority on the capitalist need to price land and to price benefits and to make grids in which value was given price. And as soon as you have that, clearly you have to plan ahead in terms of land costs and things of that kind. That is, whole series of measures which cut into, in Goodman's phrase, continual emergence of ingenious inventions. Once you lay down a scenario based on cost, you limit, in fact, invention, which is very, very much like Pound's idea of what is wrong with usury in the cantos. It's like a thick line drawn. But continually you have to think about profits. And that is like a boundary, always. That's why the usury cantos are central in the cantos, not just like some kind of nasty excrescence which most of the liberal critics, you'll find many reasons, because of the cantos treat them as somehow, you know, the pound is letting off steam at this point or something of this kind. That's absolutely central, because the question of like money profits cutting into the, again, continual emergence of ingenious inventions. And of course, he might have added, Immediately, that is geared to Wall Street, which means it cuts into regional autonomy. And the Tennessee Valley Authority originally was meant to be very regionally autonomous, but as soon as you start saying what it costs, you're into stocks and shares. In 1960, Paul Goodman, in Growing Up Absurd, returned to the idea of the city, and that's why I put the books on, because I think that as you can see the Polis idea in those two books very well, I think. Goodman has a new book out, which is absolutely startling, very thick, all about language problems. The guy's still at it. Don't worry though, this man, Paul Goodman, is going to be recognized for what he is, like a major 20th century figure, not just some kind of joke, which I... most American liberals seem to take him. His output is kind of gruesome to contemplate. Very creative man. Okay, next, we haven't got time to go into all of this. So let's look at chapter 11. And it's called The Missing Community. And here you say, okay, let's try and describe what he calls the natural community. And you'll see here, the word natural here is having the agrarian curse largely taken off it. That it is no longer some romantic organicist or enlightenment organicist problem. Page 229 to 31 in the paperback. So you know very well then that if in fact the polis is to be the place of community, it has to be thought about. The premium is placed on technical improvement and on the engineering style of functional simplicity and clarity. When a community is planned as a whole, the integration of work, living and play, where buildings have the variety of their real functions with the uniformity of the prevailing technology, where a lot of money is spent on public goods, where residents are technically educated and have a say in management, where no one drops out of society and there is an easy mobility of classes, where production is primarily for use, where social groups are laboratories for solving their own problems experimentally, where democracy begins in the town meeting and a man seeks office only because he has a program, where regional variety is encouraged and there's a pride in the republic, and young men are free of conscription, where all feel themselves citizens of the universal republic of reason, where it is a policy to give an adequate voice to the unusual and unpopular opinion, and to give a trial and a market to new enterprise, where people are not afraid to make friends, where races are factually equal, where vocation is sought out and cultivated as God-given capacity to be conserved and embellished, and where the church is the spirit of its congregation, where ordinary experience is habitually scientifically assayed by the average man, where it is felt that the suggestion of reason is practical, and speech leads to the corresponding action, where the popular culture is a daring and passionate culture, where children can make themselves useful and earn their own money. I must say, it sounds like William James to me. Where their sexuality is taken for granted, where the community carries on its important adult business and the children perform at their own pace, and where education is concerned with fostering human powers as they develop in the growing child. Now clearly, I mean, I've used it in discussions in this part as a basis. It's a pretty good one. I mean, at least there are things there that one agrees with and things I readily disagree with, but it seems to me adequate as a small program which provides the right elements, each of those sections, to be discussed. The dangers, I think, are obvious, and that is a phrase like real function could so easily be interpreted as functional in that Bauhaus sense that we looked at earlier, or in the sense that the Empire State Building is functional, or Milan Railway Station is functional, or any oppressive, modernistic, totalitarian building in any part of the world is functional. Because one asks, okay, for what purposes? Is that David Pye thing? Okay, as soon as we talk about function, you have to say function for what? And Goodman here is very much a 30s, 40s man, to my mind. A lot of very intelligent men go into the habit of saying organic and function, meaning value. You know. And he's still got it here. But I think the curse is largely taken off. Also, I feel like there's a Thoreauvian bit of old crap here to do with that, that somehow simplicity and clarity are basic values and aims. I'm not sure at all sure about that. I mean, I just feel that I would like to know what the difference between simplicity and clarity and restrictive and Puritan, for start off. I mean, what's wrong with complexity and a bit of a blur now and then, you know, and not knowing where you are, and who wants to be reasonable all the time? And I mean, the word passionate is only used when it comes to popular culture, I notice. You know, you see, there's things that one has to discuss here. The elements are all right, but there's a militating here, to my mind, against complexity in the creative, which I feel just a bit... And Paul Goodman's like this, I may say. You probably notice in his writings, he tends towards... He tends very much towards that Puritan thing inside the New England mind, you know, that somehow the simplicity and clarity of line is the strength. It's there in power a little, strangely enough. Still, on the whole, I think that Goodman's discussions are quite useful ones. We know very well, one of the problems is that town planners, or people who want to suggest the police, continually speak of the efficiency of a master plan. And here we are again in the idea of synthesis being a master plan, a total grid. I don't care whether it's philosophy, or a sonnet, or a town planning scheme, I'm talking about the same thing. If it's a mould to be filled, it's a social action. Well, I ask myself the question, can any grid guarantee against monotony of form and make certain that the ratio between community and privacy doesn't prevent happiness? Some question like that. So, when we think of the city as polis, the synthesis of buildings and spaces, where a man becomes a citizen, one asks questions like that, and like this one, can the citizen be part of the polis of some kind of cultural ecology and still live a creative life without an educational program forcing him into other people's concerns about what the creative life is? That is there a possibility of moving from Godwin's anarchism towards some kind of anarchistic structure which is not chaotic and dispersive and discursive? This is the problem we're up against continually, you probably noticed in this course. I mentioned it last time. The relationship between a form which holds together as an adequate container and a form which prevents dispersive of energy in a form which in fact crucifies inside some kind of grid. In his essay called Cause and Mythology, Charles Olson is eminently concerned there with the creation of this polis. This is an essay delivered at a speech delivered at Berkeley in 1965, and you'll see there that Olson is deeply concerned that developed all his life and never solved the problem at all, I'm not suggesting, with the possibility of transferring from Gloucester, which isn't a city at all, a very small seaport community, transferring the values there of production for use, of decentralized government and so on in the Mexican presidency to the larger structure. And don't forget ever that Charles Olson speaks as an ex-worker for the Democratic Party in Washington. Always. I mean, I feel always, yeah, I want to say that. Somebody who got very disillusioned with the Democratic Party in the 40s and 50s. And also, I have to imagine, I think I have to say too, a man whose Catholicism grew increasingly shaky. I think one must always remember about Olson, I feel, that he was a man who moves out from accepted orders, city orders, the Catholic and Democratic, towards the exploration of the possible transfer of the values in a small town community to a bigger issue. I have a problem, as I put on your essay about mayor. I don't want to go into this in at this point, if you don't mind. But my problem about mayor letters is this. I don't know if you've seen this book on barriers I've written. It covers anybody who thinks that you can take the artifacts of a thoroughly decadent, fascistic, agrarian society and make them issues of value. And you'd never dream in Olson's description of Mayan that they're like, you know, human sacrificial bastard. I find it astonishing, absolutely astonishing. It's totally grim to me that he can do it. Yeah? Okay, I can see that the glyphs are exciting. Because in a glyph, where the way the thing is cut into the stone, there's this beautiful tactile and spatial and everything that he wants. That the projective Earth image goes into the stone, and it's a good thing, right? And I can see every point where he says, right, why did the Mayans live there? Because it was beautiful. You don't have to deal with this anthropological shit about mother gods and things.
We criticize in a way that when you talk about the leaders, you know, they were like above the religion. They were the men that were in the know. And in fact, you know, I mean, he's suggesting in a way that they were evil the same way that the kind of...
I don't think he suggests anywhere, as Parham does, the complexities of the relationship between, well, let's put it in one of Parham's examples, of the fact that the Renaissance tyrants could commission what his member Malatesta did, the Tempio Rimini. You know, that you can be a tyrannical man, a bit tired in fact, what's the waste word, and at the same time, like Lorenzo de' Medici, write extremely beautiful poetry. You know, there's a problem here, to my mind, in Olson. There is an absence of, at that point with the Mayan letters, an absence of considering the relationship between the glyphs and what they suggest about a society, and, again, like function. I'm sure of this. I'm working, as you can imagine, I'm deeply involved in this, because I'm writing this book out. But one's got to say it out, you know. And I did a lot of work on this for the Byers book, to find out exactly what Byers was taking from Aztecs and Mayans, and, you know, Yucatan thing. And I got the book that Olson used on Yucatan, to one thing I picked up in London, which is kind of nice. I'm not speaking in the kind of, like, second-hand ignorance thing here. Because it matters a lot. But it's always a terrible... It's one of the biggest problems is this relationship between... I mean, in America right now, it's, to my mind, the most exciting culture in the world, no question about that. I mean, the sheer amount of creative action going on in that place, and of rethinking, politically, and of making, is second to none in the world, I swear. I know that. And yet, the structure of corporate capitalism and its extensions into the war in Vietnam are totally disastrous. Right? Now, how do you think of that community as a whole? I mean, even using my bland assumptions about interstate and something. You see what I'm saying? It's a very, very difficult matter. And I don't think Olson... I think Olson understood all this, but when it comes to my nerves, it really gets on my nerves that he doesn't do it sufficiently. Robert Duncan wrote me down about it that he and Colin Sauer used to argue endlessly about this, which interested me an awful lot. You know, about just how much information goes into cultural morphology, you know, the idea of a cultural morphology that Sauer took up. It's an issue. It's a real issue, this. Parham is scared to death that the polis might be an egalitarian grid, because he feels that the aristocratic leadership thing, you know, the priest, king, heir, in the past was so strongly dedicated to the maintenance of sufficient surplus value out of the surplus labor that works of art could be produced like a superstructure on the basis of the surface value and surface labor, you see. The idea that you might be able to produce great works of art, that is, the moments in which human beings really make things, create out of their bodies, inside a society which is not dependent on hierarchy or surplus labor and surplus value, is the issue. In my view, Olson, neither in the man Levis, or anywhere else for that matter, really grasped this one in sufficient detail. Well, speak. You're just supposed to know about it. Do you agree or not?
Fine, well, that's really informed me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't want to bully you, but I mean, you do know about it, Olson, I know. Yeah, it is an issue, you see there, inside Olson, very strongly. And I speak as a man, as you know, who intensely admires this man. Mm. But I always get angry about people and disappointing him. Including me. Yeah. Well, and the quick reason I want to use from the clause of mythology is this. We live in a time when the future lies as much in the genetic as it does in the morphological. That is like, you know, you have to understand Genesis. Another way, using a kind of lovely, great, cunning word. But that's it. That's a hell of a nice sentence. We live in a time where the future lies as much in the genetic as it does in the morphological. Okay, what we're asking then, using that, is what is the morphology of the city? That is, what is its structural form? That's what morphology means. Such then, it can accommodate our sense of the genetic. That is, growth on given factors. Now, the case against the city is usually put like this. In a city, men are instruments of each other's life. Each man as an entity and end in himself is disregarded. And therefore the basis of a morality based on mutuality is weakened. That's the case usually. Now this argument assumes that it assumes a structural definition of community as a face-to-face relationship between what I want to call, with some rapidity I admit, whole men. It assumes this can only take place in rural communities of very small towns. Let's take Gloucester, Massachusetts for a minute, which is like a fishing village come up in the world a bit. Right? This social structure is seen to be irrelevant to the structure of the metropolis. And what happens is the two things are kept apart. You get the nostalgia for ruralism built into the argument. You know, because only in these small areas. The Puritan and Virginian settlements are often used as stasis, but I want to say there, daily confrontation didn't surely produce community of whole men in those two places. Boy, they confronted each other in those Puritan settlements. You know, every one way or another. So I think that confrontation, face-to-face confrontation, is not necessarily productive of a creative interface. That is, we don't know each other better necessarily within either one structure or the other. I want to take off that whole idea that somehow in one structure or the other, that in rural community face-to-face or small-town community face-to-face confrontation, and in the city area, there is a productive, a community interface. I think we must like forget that for a minute, to put it on one side. Okay. Let's try and say something like this then, that a city as a neighborhood is the city neighborhood inside the bigger area can be considered as part of multiple environments and resources. That is, you move. You are mobile inside the area. This is the secret, I think, to get out of this curse. That you move inside the area, you are not a fixed object inside it. That you, in fact, intersect at any point that you wish. And the city provides a series of environments. I don't mean series in a linear sense. I mean that you can go from one to the other in any order you wish. Now, the grid then must facilitate that, and it must be an open grid that facilitates it. Community varies, one wants to say, between functions in environments used day and night. Variables, randomness inside an area which encloses you so you don't waste energy, but no more. You see, let me give you an example. The community, ironically, can be at its most intense when the city breaks down. I think of New York in 1966. When I was living downtown, there was a complete, during the celebrated blackout, and during the transport strike, there was a complete transport stoppage and total darkness on these two occasions. And it was extraordinary. There was a little bit of thuggery going on, but I don't think much more than usual. But there was certainly increased community, you know. And as you know, just the point where the birth rate went up. So the, I mean, people apparently lost the pill in the dark. That's what it was said, but I mean, I think, what was going on there. There was some joke or anything like that about it. But certainly, the birthday did go up in that time, which is very curious, isn't it?
It was related to TV, wasn't it?
Yeah,
something
going
to
tell you about
it. Really?
The way, for example, in India, the way you reduce the population to reduce TV.
Yeah, I mean, they stayed up too late, yeah. Now, I was just trying to think what it meant by introducing TV. They meant that they didn't get to bed as early, or...
Right.
Yeah.
They were bombarded by the rain.
Oh, God. Oh, wow. There's that as well. Late nights and ray bomb. Oh, God. Yeah. But certainly that... I'll just use that as an example, that community feeling can happen when the over-systematized, over-organized breaks. So that I'm interested in that. I think that we have to say something that community feeling may be something which happens intermittently. I think, I get a feeling that a lot of the writing going on in America right now about the possibility of community in the polis is mistaken because, with all its goodwill, because it suggests that somehow we have to be a community all the time. I don't want to be. I don't think that community is intermittent. And the privacy and community are the two areas, right? And now and then there's privacy, and then community. That is, community feeling may happen intermittently when required and when it's able to function. Otherwise, you get this ghastly thing of perpetual and total confrontation, which would be very exhausting. It would be as exhausting and very similar to Noam Brown's polymorphous perversity. I mean, if you're having sex to every orifice all the time, it would be like having no privacy at all in a non-community, if you see what I mean. He's up there, that's what he says. Like, fun, but it's exhausting. I mean, you can only have one orgasm, like, well, even that guy in Kinsey, what was it, 32 a week? You know, I mean, I think there's a... Don't you feel in life against death there's this extraordinary idea that somehow one has endless sexual energy? Isn't that the basis of that book? I think it's weird. Maybe I'm just like... No. I'm not sure I want to spend that much time either, by the way. That's something else. Anyway, the idea of, like, you know, being polymorphously perverse in a closed environment is going to be total hell. Okay then, maybe, and another thing I've brought back to here, in a city, sometimes very much easier to live among strangers than in a rural community where everybody knows everybody else. It's often the choice, you know. I mean, in a small town, privacy is a rare commodity. Very rare indeed, right? Don't you think so? She's talking about that. Okay. Choice, then, of privacy or group activity is easier for most people in a city, is what I want to say. That is, a man may operate, and I mean here man or woman, a man may operate a spectrum then between an anonymity on the one hand and being absolutely known on the other. He can operate his own spectrum better in the city, to my mind, because of this multiple environmental choice. Mm-hmm. No, sir?
Is it a group of small communities?
No, but I'm just thinking this is the other way.
So that one person goes from his area of privacy, area of known, like in his own basic community, he travels to another one where he's anonymous.
Yeah.
But what's the reaction of the people who are in that group where he is anonymous? Is that in fact completely alienated?
Well, this is
they're opposed also.
Yes, but I mean, my point is this is happening continually all the time, and lots of people. I'm just taking one man out. I can say, okay, men, if you like, men and women operating their own spectrums between it. Right, I'm not leaning down to the grid. I'm trying to counter the separation between rural and urban in terms of value, that's all. And then pump into the thing, the space I've got, the where I think one might look for this kind of thing. I mean, you know, there's the man or the woman with her family, his or her family, job, union, club, bar, creche, PTA, you know, and so on, right? There's that area. If that was all, it would be murder, wouldn't it? I think it's known very much these days that unless you are alone for a certain amount of time a day according to your need, you can go mad. You know. Animals certainly do. I mean, I've got animals. I don't want to go as far as old Skinner with his great war cry, you know, the rat is always right. But certainly, rats do go mad when they're put in perpetual community. That's what I'm not trying to lay down too many laws here. I just want to like, suggest the problems, right, here, of what the city has to be. Yeah, Virginia.
The continued question is, are there areas within a city that are neutral?
Yeah.
But if one has a community, if he leaves the community, are there areas that he can go into that are not community?
Right. I think I'm just trying to lay down some of the things needed. Okay, yes, I think there must, I'm calling that private.
Right.
And I think that, yes, that is what I'm saying. But I think there are techniques for doing this, because old watch's name, Albert, now known as Baba Ram Dass, I have a tape of him talking about this, where he says there are techniques by which you can, in fact, make your privacy in very difficult circumstances, you know, by meditational techniques. So one needs a minimal space in that. It's very difficult in a city which is dedicated to so many other things. That's why I'm saying that's why I'm talking about a spectrum. It's not a very good analogy, but it is very nice, it seems to me, to be totally anonymous as well as known. Do you see? And that gives you the area of privacy. I mean, you can be private walking down a crowded city street, is what I'm saying, as well as sitting in a room, you see? Two different kinds of privacy. The strain of being known in a city is a very difficult matter, you know, for many people, obviously.
I think come back to the problem there, which Phil mentioned.
Yeah.
No,
sorry, I have not got into it. I beg your
pardon. There's just a fine line between privacy, like privacy and anonymity.
Yeah.
And anonymity being, very alienating.
I can see this. I can see that. I think that I think it can be an alienating to be a member of a perpetual community too. I mean, I speaking of a man serving in the navy, and that was on ships with like water around you, and you just can't get off. Do you know what I mean? And the sense of being continually encumbered with each other, you know, it's tricky. I mean, a lot of problems to do with what is called discipline. are to do with the enabling of that area to be as operative between privacy and the public issue, that is, of what it is, firing the guns or whatever. regulated bailout. I mean, it's very serious indeed, I must say. There's one of the problems that is very rarely discussed, but you just have to, to do with contiguity. Everybody's like, and there's no interface, really. It's just like, yow, right against each other.
Because it seems like the only way that you could possibly hope that Pauls could work is when you're dealing with a completely healthy individual.
But yeah, I do think that health is based very much on, you see, why I'm against liberal psychologists is that they always think that somehow you can be healthy in the conditions as they are in the city, that somehow living in Tower Hamlets isn't neurotic in itself. You see what I mean? So one has to, that's why I'm interested in the space of this thing. This is Olsen's. You know, and most people are now concerned, okay, what do we do with that space? How do we divide it to get this privacy community thing going? I got a quotation from one writer here, who goes so far as to say, I quote, "The crowded physical conditions under which urbanites live have led to an increased moral sensitivity." Like disgust, as they say. I think that's an absurd generalization to make. But it may well contain a truth. I mean, you know, that somehow in an urban area like that, the very crowding might, in fact, evolve some kind of essential laws of restriction of freedom of movement towards neutrality. But I think that would have to be discussed in given cases. The next point I think one must make is the idea that cities are, and I suggested this last time, the world's chief civilizing agencies. And as Lewis Mumford says in that famous book of his, the civilization is the culture of cities. But, again, we have to realize that the urban renewal might end up as those housing precincts in Hubert Selby's Last Exit to Brooklyn. So I think the Last Exit to Brooklyn here could be a document, as it is, of course, because it's based on Selby's own experience, of what happens in an urban renewal area. It isn't an old city, is my point. Those are new, where he's talking about a newly built housing precinct, isn't he? Replacing an old dockyard area, you see, in Brooklyn. That is the point of that book. That is a central point. It is a new built housing precinct, which is inheriting all the morality of crowding. That is, you have a hell, in fact. And you notice that hell is always depicted in the Middle Ages as being crowded. Dante thought otherwise, but that's something else. I don't know if I've mentioned this, but remind me if I have. I think I have, yes, but one of the most interesting books on this is this book by Serge Chemayev and Christopher Alexander. I think I mentioned this book, haven't I, called Community and Privacy already. No? I think so. Anyway, I've forgotten it's by Chemayev, 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 Serge Chemayev, and Christopher Alexander, 1963, Community and Privacy. It's an MIT... Joint Center for Urban Studies work. What they demonstrate there is possible plans for a community which includes privacy. And their design of the city takes the form of mobiles and constellations, which goes right back to all our ideas in this course. The idea of the mobile, the idea of the constellation as possible plans. That is, they oppose the Jeffersonian grid of rectangular lines imposed on the Earth's surface, and they oppose also any kind of mechanical grid into which human beings are to be poured, as it were, like a mold. Let me remind you, too, that the image that comes up again and again, and that is the image of the Californian city in Thomas Pynchon's novel, The Crying of Lot 49. I've used this again and again. Let me remind you that the heroine there, Oedipa Myers, at one point driving along above the city called San Narciso, and she has this vision of the city as a printed circuit. That is the updating of the Jeffersonian grid. The printed circuit laid off the land and called San Narciso. But notice the implications in the title of the interned, introspective, deathly city. Not because it's enormous, but because it's a mold to be filled. And again, like Charles Olson defining technics as a science of the art, here they say, page 255, Community and Privacy, they say the aim is to produce a physical environment made from artistic intuition and technical capacity. There are two phrases, artistic intuition and technical capacity inside the single design. Not the fusion of design, which will be urban sprawl, but the combination. And what they say is this: civilized man gives high priority to the development of a unified field of environmental control in which art will once again be tempered by the purposeful direction of science and science inspired by the insights of art. I mention this because, like, notice that they are into this idea of a unified field of environmental control, but they know very well that the work of art isn't produced by just learning discipline. There's that whole random area we've been looking at. So, the fear of being private might be as much part of the tyrannical city as the fear of group pressure. And one way of doing it will be to give a number of opportunities. One of the most interesting books, if you want to study this whole area of the opposition to the city, is called The Intellectual versus the City. It's a very interesting little book. It's a little tiny paperback, came out in 1962, by Morton and Lucia White. M-O-R-T-O-N, Morton and Lucia White, The Intellectual versus the City. And its subtitle will give you the clue to what it's about, From Thomas Jefferson to Frank Lloyd Wright. This is a book about the backlog of anti-in-city intellectualism. That is the line which perpetuates the deception that the place in which the elementary values of self-development and community and privacy can only be found is not the city. In fact, I don't want to go into this because it's historical and mostly doesn't deal with the 20th century at all. Which is a very useful little book. But the last sentences of the book read, the wilderness, the isolated farm, the plantation, the self-contained New England town, the detached neighborhood, are things of the American past. All the world, the city now, and there is no escaping urbanization, not even in outer space. And I want to put that with a quotation from Marshall McLuhan's book, Counterblast, which is page 12. The farmer no longer exists today. Today is a city man. Any highway eatery with its TV set, newspaper, and magazine is as cosmopolitan as New York or Paris. But it is an illusion to think of that, these kind of farming values in that particular. Let me quote to you also a thing of McLuhan's in one of the issues of his magazine Explorations. This is Explorations number 6. It came out in 1956. Cities were always a means of achieving some degree of simultaneity of association and awareness among men. Cities were always a means of achieving some degree of simultaneity of association and awareness among men. What the family and the tribe had done in this respect for a few, the city did for the many. The oral and acoustic space of tribal cultures had never met visual reconstruction of the past. For the walls between men and between arts and societies were built on the written and visually arresting words. And as you can imagine, he moves on there to this idea of the retribalization, which we discussed more earlier. Certainly then, I'm not just putting those quotations together to suggest that one of the main factors, I think, in the discussion of the city has been this idea of the possibility of urban renewal, not dismissal, necessarily, I think. One of the ways in which you can see the dangers, and I'm just going to mention the book just in case you don't know it, magnificent work of what happens in human relationships in the city area is Jules Henry's book called Culture Against Man. This is quite marvelous. 1963, Jules Henry, J-U-L-E-S, Henry, Culture Against Man, paperback, by the way, 1963. I mean, if you want to do it quickly, if you're ever teaching or you want to get yourself in quickly, put Last Exit to Brooklyn of Selby with this book, and you'll have a great deal of what you need about the problems of urban renewal vis-à-vis human beings. Jules Henry's book is a collection, description of breakdowns in human relationships written by sociologists and psychologists in various American city structures. Very useful book indeed, I may say. But the guy who, I'm going to have copies, let me just tell you what I'm going to go afterwards. The guy who really is, that we have to look at, who is so influential in America, among corporate capitalists, and therefore is perpetuating the malign city, is a man called Constantine A. Doxiadis. Constantine A. Doxiadis, D-O-X-I-A-D-I-S. And I want to say a little bit about his highly influential ideas. I mean, he is the man employed by corporate businessmen to build new cities. And he is like the Herman Kahn of urban development. A really scary guy. So let's have a look at him. Very briefly, Arthur. So I'll just mention some of the books and some of the things that go on in those books, and then you'll be okay. And then I think we've done mostly with what I wanted to do. This relaxation topic, this is a student of mine, Frank, made some copies of this for the class, and I just remembered I had some spare, so I brought him here. Because of this, because he is very important as the typical planner with enormous power, who is being used right now as the comprehensive engineer figure in the Fuller mentions, and that the Goodmans are skeptical of. He is one of the most powerful international consultants in planning, and is therefore central in the mystique of grand planning synthesis. It is a mystique, but somehow, if you have a big grand plan, a large grid, you're in business. Now his fame, Doxiadis' fame, is largely based on his beliefs that data can be evaluated to make a single optimum design for the city. The planning of which is then infallible. You computerize the data, the computer evaluates the data, and out comes a single optimum design for an infallible plan. This has enormous appeal to the mystique of corporate action. And Doxiadis is the man of this master plan, and therefore in great demand. One or two books he's done as well. Major work, I think, is called is the one called Echistics. E-K-I-S-T-I-C-S. Echistics, 1968. And here he defines his work. Echistics, 1968. The Science of Human Settlements, he calls it. These guys have the gift of language, which is also kind of like difficult. The Science of Human Settlements. And his words are now recurrent. The terms he uses to enshrine his sound are these. Entopia is the city that works.
Entopia.
E-N-T-O-P-I-A. Entopia. Dianapolis is the changing city. You'll hear senators using these words all the time. I think he was born in Athens, but I mean, I think he's completely metropolitan and lived most of the time in America. Dianapolis, the changing city. The large-scale version of this is Dynametropolis, and a bit further on is Dynamegalopolis. And you know, like, language is like our handles and hooks to make things, to make ideas like this circulate. People love to use phrases like dynamegalopolis in board meetings. Yeah, you say it because and then it seems that something is being said. It's like Allen Ginsberg says in Reality Sandwiches, language, 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 language. And it's black magic. It's like saying, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. And you hope that there will be an evocation. Like, you know, the genie will appear. And you want magic lamps, and they're very linguistic, if you see what I mean, to mix the metaphor from here. Okay, the world city beyond that is called Ecumenopolis, which is like Pope John's idea, but taken a bit further, to be snotty from this. You should connect up the Doxiadis idea of Ecumenopolis with Buttman's idea of the world island, and McLuhan's idea of the global village. You see, this is the magic area. You say, Ecumenopolis, world island, global village. And boy, everybody starts to spark. Without asking really, you know, whether in fact the world, the language, is more than a magic spell to bring about something that somebody else wants. Old Faust here again. Now, when he's studying the urban area of Detroit, which took to be one of his, I mean, imagine how he loves Detroit. He studied Detroit, the urban area, and he shows 49 million alternatives, which he calls his basic. I mean, this guy's on a big scale, which helps. 49 million alternatives of his basics. The basics are, and see how he's, again, he's making a language grid for a city grid, is the relationship, you see. The basics are these: nature, man, notice the separation immediately, by the way, society, shells. By shells, he means things which go into things that contain things, like houses, factories. so networks, and these are related to. You put these underneath, which he does in the book. Man's nature, man, society, shells, networks are his five basics, and under that he places a relationship to residence, commerce, industry, defense. In Detroit, notice. It's very accurate. Because the idea that people living in Detroit don't think of national defense for them is ludicrous. Yeah. Residence, commerce, industry, defense. And then their relation in turn, the next line, to money, labor, materials, and land. Plot line then, the basics, nature, man, society, shells, networks. Then the relationship underneath to residence, commerce, industry, defense. And then, in turn, the relationship to money, labor, materials, and land. And inside that linguistic structural grid, he makes his 49 million alternatives. to eliminate choices, and I put it very carefully, to eliminate choices, he uses a method he calls, and again notice the language spell, isolation of dimensions and elimination of alternatives. We look at the capital letter, it spells idea. Right. Isolation of dimensions, capitalize each of the words, isolation of dimensions and elimination of alternatives. You get IDEA. The appeal of this, you want to be absolutely certain you grasped it, because it is very, very important. Imagine there's all boredom guys saying idea every now and then. So much then for neutrality masquerading as techniques and planning. He does. Acoustics goes on to construct 54 laws. And like this is that magic of number thing we looked into in connection with tantra and music earlier. Do you remember? Make no mistake about it. The magic of number is still around. I'm not going to go into these 54 laws. Let me give you number 34.